again, she's no more sort of historically accurate than the sort of the blonde Cleopatras. The sort of 19th century Orientalist paintings of Cleopatra show her looking, as I've said, like a sort of Turkish dancing girl out of a harem. Or Delacroix's Cleopatra actually looks like a sort of queen of the gypsies, sort of great big gold earrings. Certainly not like a first century BC Hellenistic queen. Indeed, we don't really know what Cleopatra's complexion would have been. Her father was the last of the Ptolemies, who were Greek. We don't know who her mother was. She was probably a concubine who could have come from anywhere. I mean, it's been suggested that Cleopatra might have been black. I think it's unlikely. But of course, in her time, people didn't use the words black and white the way they're used now. I mean, people of the northern shore and the southern shore, the Mediterranean, were all brownish, and they didn't distinguish one from t'other quite as clearly as became the custom after the beginning of the European empires. So, her appearance changes, but as I say, the moment when she goes from blonde to brunette is the moment when Napoleon set off to Egypt, initiating a process whereby the kind of European powers began to accumulate empires in Asia, Africa, and all the non-European world. Whereupon Cleopatra's story becomes a story about Orientalism. And very often these shifts in appearance, shifts in meanings of the story, or in the structure of the story, reflect a shift in the sort of preconceptions or the preoccupations of the culture which produces them. So that for Chaucer and his contemporaries, Cleopatra's story is a story about the ethics of suicide. For Shakespeare, it's a story about passion and the very great dangers of passion. And I think in Shakespeare's play, when Antony first comes on, he's embracing Cleopatra, and he says, they're kissing, and he says, the nobleness of life is to do thus. And to sort of post-romantic audiences, you tend to think, oh, isn't that lovely? They love each other so much. But to Elizabethan audiences, to say that the nobleness of life was to be kissing your lover was undignified. It showed that Antony had got his priorities wrong. And there's a whole debate about passion and its value and its dangers goes through all the kind of Renaissance versions, and Shakespeare's is only the most famous of several dozen plays about the subject written in the sort of century and a half around that period, in which Antony is succumbing to passion and exposes him to all sorts of dangers, not least, of course, that of becoming a woman, because it's only women who succumb to passion and men are supposed to be more stoic and dignified. So that's the theme for that period. And then soon thereafter, in the 17th century, Cleopatra's story becomes one about marriage. And in Dryden's play, All for Love, Cleopatra is very worried about the fact that she's not properly married, which is not something that Shakespeare's Cleopatra or any of the kind of earlier classical versions of the story seem to pay much mind to at all. But Dryden's Cleopatra comes on saying, nature intended me to be a wife, a silly, harmless household dove, which is not really quite how we normally think of Cleopatra. And then in the next sort of tranche of time between the kind of English Revolution and the French and American Revolutions, the story is most often told as a story about politics, about the rival merits of monarchy and republic, or sort of centralised monarchy, or a monarchy in which the kind of the old aristocracy are allowed to have their way. It depends whether it's being told in France, whether it's being told in England or in Germany. There are many different versions, but the love story kind of sinks to the edges, really, and the sort of the central part of the story is a debate between the male characters about constitutional politics. But then, with the end of the 18th century, it becomes again, it becomes a story about empire. And then during the 19th century, something new comes in, and Cleopatra becomes a femme fatale, because the discourse about colonialism begins to overlap with the discourse of sexual violence. And you have a lot of employment kind of metaphors where, you know, conquest is equated with rape. Antony's taking over Cleopatra becomes the Europe taking over the Orient, and so on and so forth. And very often there's something violent in that sort of erotic metaphor. And in 1837, Pushkin starts a new story of Cleopatra, which oddly enough becomes the story about her throughout the 19th century. There are very few versions which tell the story we all know about, you know, Antony, the Battle of Actium, the Asp. The main story in all the sort of versions, like the one in which Sarah Bernhardt starred for decade after decade as she got sort of older and older and less equipped to play the part, used this story, which comes from Pushkin. He kind of elaborated it from two lines in the work of a late Byzantine historian, in which it's said that Cleopatra liked to have a new lover every night, and the wretched man would be put to death in the morning to make way for the next one. And Pushkin imagines this scene. He imagines Cleopatra manless in Alexandria. Antony is not around. And she announces that any man brave enough to volunteer will be honoured with a night in her bed, but he has to understand that he will be executed at sunrise. And somewhat surprisingly, several people do volunteer. And in Pushkin's version, which he liked so much, he actually wrote three different poems on the theme, that there's one, there's a sort of a fine, dignified elder. She doesn't seem very interested in him. And then there's a splendid, muscly sort of soldier. And she, not so sure. And then steps forward this lovely, sort of milky skinned, ephebic young man, young enough to be her son. And Cleopatra says, yes, we'll have you. And he's dragged off to her bed and has a night such as, you know, men could only dream of. It's all wonderful, no doubt. But then he's killed in the morning. And this story seems to have really thrilled 19th century men all over Europe. And in France, Germany, Italy, England, you get versions of it, each one more lurid than the last. And then it comes sort of, there are sort of early film versions of it as well. And a great many sort of minor poems, properly forgotten, which if you dig them out of the library, they're really quite astonishing in their kind of the shamelessness of their sadomasochism. Anyway, so there we have. So Cleopatra becomes the killer, the femme fatale. And of course, that sort of image of woman as someone whose sexual power is so dangerous that to touch is to die, is absolutely sort of riddled with misogyny. It's a hostile image. But I think it's also more complicated than that, in that most of the men who are elaborating that image were describing exactly what they wanted. And Cleopatra has been imagined as the satisfaction of all possible desires, and it turns out that men's desires have, over the two millennia that separate her from us, very often been extremely self-destructive. And there's a line in one of Keats's letters which I think nicely sums it up, where he says that he'd been to a tea party in Hampstead where he'd met a very pretty Anglo-Indian girl, slightly sort of dark, so he made him think about Cleopatra. And he said she wasn't quite a Cleopatra, perhaps, but she was at least a Charmian. And then he says, I would like her to ruin me. And that, I think, is what for two millennia men have been hoping Cleopatra would do. And that, I think, is where I'll leave her.